Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Amy Schifrin. I am on the faculty here at Trinity School for Ministry, and I also serve as president of the North American Lutheran Seminary. And I teach for both schools in liturgy and homiletics. I've also asked that a new sign be put up at my door. In addition to those things, I wanted to say director of frivolity. Because every court needs a jester, right? I'm very pleased announce the speaker for our fifth session and introduce Dr. and Father Esau McCauley. He is a father, a priest, and he is also married and the father of four children, a father and a father. He is an assistant professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at Northeastern Seminary, and he has served as a rector and spiritual life director. His scholarly research, as you may know, focuses on Paul's letters to the Galatians and the Romans, and he's not even a Lutheran. It's so interesting. And Second Temple Judaism, see frivolity, and Greco-Roman backgrounds to the New Testament. And he's the director of the Anglican Multi-Ethnic Network of the Anglican Church of North America. So it's wonderful to have him here. His topic for this day is Black Jesus, Race and Identity in Jewish and Irenaean Perspective. With that, let us welcome him.
As you all can see, I actually, like a good scholar, changed the title. It is, what is the basis for Black identity in anthropology, the question that you all really wanted to hear about. Messianic Christology and recapitulation as a way forward. And on a completely unrelated note, I just got a text from my sister who just welcomed a child into this world. And so, welcome the latest member of the McCauley clan, even though she's now a Lewis, but I'm gonna claim it as our own. So the first part. A narrative of decline, the place of Black anthropology on the world stage. I was quite pleased to be invited to address you all on the subject of Christian anthropology and its promise for our day. But I will warn you that I'm operating something or somewhat above my pay grade. I'm a New Testament scholar by trade, and while of course Christian anthropology grows out of our reading of biblical text, the construction of a full-orbed anthropology is often the work of theologians. But rather than letting our specializations turn into bunkers from which we lob bombs at one another, with each side saying to the other, you're not doing it right, or you're using the wrong language, I think it's important that we talk to one another from time to time. That also means, though, that one day I'm going to invite Joel or Christina, one of the other theologians here, to give a talk on Ephesians or Galatians to see how they do. But nonetheless, we are here. And I thought, and I hope it's not pedantic that I did it, that I wanted to actually highlight a few questions that were supposed to guide our time together. I do this because while I affirm the overall goals of the conference, I think that if we're not careful, we can screen out the experiences of people of color. And since it is my job as the resident Black person in this august gathering of people, I must keep you all on your toes, or at least step on a few. You didn't invite me except to cause trouble, so I'm gonna cause some trouble. So here are the questions that were supposed to guide our time together. This is on the website. What does it mean to be human? What does it mean to be made in the image of God? Many observers agree that Western society is becoming increasingly post-human, dismissive of historic notions of the unique worth and dignity of human beings. How does the Christian theology of human nature, a Christian anthropology, engage this trend? According to these questions, then, we're in a unique place in which the historic notions of human worth are being called into question. In other words, this conference is set up to address a potential problem of decline that's happening in our day. But here's the problem. For African Americans, the story of Christian anthropology in the United States is decidedly not a story of decline from a consensus of the worth of Black bodies and souls. Instead, and Dr. Cortez spoke about this yesterday, Our story has been one of a denial of our basic humanity. Our struggle is not trying to conceive what it means to be human in a post-human age, but rather to be treated as human in any age. So first, a dip into our past. In his book on Christian theology and the origin of race, Willie Jennings quotes a Jesuit, and forgive me for not knowing how to pronounce his name correctly, Alexandro Valignano, a missionary to Japan. And he's important because Valignano sees Japanese converts as very valuable assets to the church if at least we can convert them. So he sees the Japanese as potential good converts. I think about this when I think about my Anglican brothers and sisters. It's like, we would love it if we just got the people who love NPR to become Christian, right? They basically have the right politics, right? They just need Jesus. So this is what our guy says about the people of Mozambique, and we can assume the rest of Africa. And he does not regard them nearly as promising. This is what he says. They are a very untalented race, incapable of grasping our holy religion or practicing it. Because of their naturally low intelligence, they cannot rise above the level of the census. They lack any culture and are given to savage ways and vices. As a consequence, they live like brute beasts. They are a race born to serve with no natural aptitude for governing. So if Valignano can be seen as representative of the people of his day, then the African slave trade, which grew up around this time, was rooted in the denial of the image of God and people of color. If you can skip ahead a generation and arrive on the shores of the United States, we find the Senator James Henry Hammond from the great state of South Carolina saying the following during a speech before the Senate in 1858 on the eve of the Civil War. This is what he has to say. In all social systems, there must be a class to do menial duties, to perform the drudgery of life. That is a class requiring but a lower order of intellect and skill. Fortunately for the South, she found a race adapted to that purpose at her hand, a race inferior to her own, but eminently qualified in temper, vigor, and docility, in capacity to stand the climate, to answer all her purposes. We use them for our purpose, and we call them slaves. We have found them slaves by the common consent of mankind. And to be even a little bit more punchy, I thought I would quote from the London Anthropological Society, right? This is the anthropology conference. Here we go. The human family is composed of a certain number of species or races. The white or Caucasian is the most elevated, and the Negro, the most subordinate of all races, in the organic structure and therefore in their faculties. I take it as read then that the full humanity of people of African descent has been a question from the beginning of the slave trade up through the Civil War. It was then encased in law during Jim Crow. So please indulge me again as I give you a couple of the relevant Jim Crow laws. So we've gone from the beginning of the slave trade up through Jim Crow so far, really quickly. From the great state of Alabama, the state of my birth, we find this law. No person or corporation shall require any white female nurse to nurse in wards or rooms in hospitals, either public or private, in which Negro men are placed. So white nurses don't have to serve Negro patients. All marriages between, this is from the great state of, Florida. All marriages between a white person and a Negro person, or between a white person or a person of Negro descent, down to the fourth generation, are thereby forever prohibited. From the great state of Georgia, the officer in charge shall not bury or allow to be buried any colored person upon ground set apart or used for the burial of white persons. Even in death, we are separated. I'll say more about this later as we deal with the question of a fully formed back anthropology. But I want to ask this question, and it's only partly rhetorical as we think about the history of black anthropology in America. In what year would you say that the majority of the United States of America recognized the full dignity of black bodies and souls? Stated differently, in what year, if you had to put a number on it, did the race-based hierarchy outlined above become socially unacceptable? And if you add to that this second question, that there's always a lag between what is socially unacceptable and people's opinions, right? There's a point where you can no longer be racist publicly, but it was kind of okay to be racist in private. And when did we actually get to the point where it was actually impolite to be racist even in private? The 80s, 90s, 2000s, yesterday, we're waiting, right? Regardless of how one answers these questions, it is clear that the question of a black anthropology, an account of what makes us human, has operated along a slightly different track than the mainstream theological discourse that functions as something as a frame for this conference. So to turn our attention then from the European gaze upon the black person to black theological and cultural reflection itself, the question becomes, how have we as a people given an account of what it means for us to be human? And this question is going to occupy the rest of my time. So this is an inner black conversation that I'm having in front of you all. It's fine. You invited me. I want to argue that African Americans have provided three answers to the question of black identity. And the first is not particularly Christian, but it's nonetheless important. Secular scholars have used a particular reading of black history as the basis for our identity. Second, and this is where it becomes somewhat Christian, liberation theologians have seen the Exodus narrative as analogous to the black slave narrative, and therefore as a starting point for our identity. And the final account that I'll address really briefly is similar to the second. Some theologians have argued that black existence in the United States of America is utterly cruciform. We suffer unjustly even unto death at the hands of the state. Therefore, Jesus as the one who suffers unjustly at the hands of the state is black. And this black Jesus then forms the basis for black understanding of our suffering and our eventual vindication. I'll examine the strengths and the weaknesses of these proposals before turning to two sources for a positive foundation for black anthropology. I'll argue that a black anthropology must be rooted in a messianic Christology. And this messianic Christology makes much of Jesus's particularity as Jewish and kingly in order to affirm its universality. Second, I will argue that the doctrine of recapitulation, as found in Irenaeus, did I say that right? Okay. He's not black, so I can call him what I want to call him. Okay. points the way towards an anthropology which unites all the people of God. So, black history and our struggle as the basis for our identity. So how do you form an identity when it's been systematically denied to your people? How do you understand who you are when your own name comes from your masters? I'm Esau Macaulay, not because my family can trace their family to the lost tribes of Scotland, but because a minor family in Scotland, and I went and looked this up when I was there, who didn't even have their own tartan, like a minor family, wanted to make a better life for themselves, and they moved to the United States. One answer to the question of the foundation of black identity has been to put our finger on our painful story and use that story as the basis for constructing an understanding of our place in the world. In his classic, The Souls of Black Folks, W.E.B. Du Bois speaks about the reality of being both black and American as a two-ness that you have to strive to keep intact. He says, the history, see this, this is the beginning of it, the history of the Negro in America, this is how he forms our self-consciousness, is the history of this strife, this longing to attain self-conscious manhood, to merge his double self into a better and truer self. In this meaning, he wishes neither of ourselves to be lost. He would not Africanize America, for America has too much to teach the world in Africa. And he would not bleach his Negro soul in the flood of white Americanism. That's the important part, sorry. Every time I read it, it gets to me. For he knows that the Negro blood has a message for the world. He simply wishes to make it possible for a man to be both a Negro and American without being cursed and spit upon by his fellows, without having the doors of opportunity closed roughly in his face. To be black, then, according to Du Bois, is to engage in this struggle to be free and black in America. But it goes deeper than this. In order to engage in this struggle for identity, we must tell the story of that struggle. And this story for personhood the black story for personhood stands in stark contrast to the story that America likes to tell itself. Both stories, the black account and the white account, are theological accounts of American history, but they have different aims. The story that America likes to tell itself is the story of the discovery of an untamed land, a partnership with the original inhabitants, that's Thanksgiving, right? Of the desire for religious freedom, of the creation of the most just system of government that humanity has ever known. Americans, granted, there was this unfortunate reality of slavery in the treatment of the first inhabitants of this country, but look how far we come. It is possible to look at our supposed triumph over racism, especially with the election of a black president, not once but twice, as yet another glory of this country. The bad parts weren't so bad, and the glories grow in the telling. This greatness is the foundation of a certain form of American identity. If there was an examination of European American anthropology, there would be a widespread belief in its unique gifting and calling by God. There are people created and chosen to rule. But black persons can only have a bit part in this narrative. We are oppressed for a while, but finally free. We are the backdrop for someone else's triumph. Black history, then, as the foundation for black identity, offers a different theological account of the history of this country, even when that account is secular. By denying the providential ordering of what I call the European glory narrative, it calls into question the God in this narrative. It is a form of atheism as protest. If your God told you to do this to us, then we deny him. This, to be clear, is not a denial of the God of the Bible, but a denial of the God of this narrative. Frederick Douglass, the great abolitionist and theologian, said this towards the end of his biography. And forgive me for giving a long quote, but I like Fred. I have, in several instances, and I've quoted this almost everywhere I go. I find it its way into every speech that I give. But here it goes. It's always relevant. I have, in several instances, spoken in such a tone and manner, respecting religion, as may possibly lead those unacquainted with my religious views to suppose me an opponent of all religion. What I've said respecting and against religion, I mean strictly to apply to the slave-holding religion of this land. See that distinction between the two? With no possible reference to Christianity proper, for between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference, so wide that to receive one as good, pure, and holy is a necessity to reject the other as bad, corrupt, and wicked. To be a friend of one is of necessity to be the enemy of the other. I love the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. I therefore hate the corrupt, slave-holding, women-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, and hypocritical Christianity of this land. The black account of American history, then, is a bloody and dark story that begins not with the Mayflower, but on the good ship Jesus. For those of you who don't know, that one of the first slave ships that brought Africans to this soul was actually named the Good Ship Jesus, or nicknamed that. It is a story of middle passages, auctioning blocks, sexual assault, and divided families. It is a heartbreaking tale that makes one weep to look upon it. But in the secular black telling, it becomes a story of a people who bear up under suffering. It is a story of the constant affirmation of our humanity in the face of a system that attempted to deny it. And some have claimed, this is the important part, some have claimed that this story unites African Americans in a way that transcends even the Christian story. Here again. And this is by a theologian named Hoyt. There is a shared transcendent cultural reality experienced by black Christians and non-Christians alike, black suffering. Black suffering bears and is borne a double burden. On the one hand, black suffering shares the suffering that is common to all humanity, sickness, broken homes, tragedies, death, accidents, wars. On the other hand, listen to this, black suffering has been compounded by slavery, discrimination, and racism. This sociological grid of blacks provides a solidarity that transcends even membership in the Christian religion. Bigger than Christianity, our united suffering. So what makes us who we are as black people? What unites us? According to them, it is our suffering. We are those who have suffered and yet we lived. What is a Christian to make then of such things? Is it true that the suffering of my people unites us one to another more than the blood of Christ unites us to our fellow Christians? One can see how such a statement could be made, even if we must reject it. How much kinship did the black slave or black Christian feel with his white Christian neighbor under slavery and Jim Crow? I've also experienced this black kinship when there are two black people in a room and it gets uncomfortably racist. And one set of eyes finds the other, and we say to ourselves, "Did you hear what I just heard?" To which the other one answers, "Yes, I did." And we ask again, "Is it time to leave?" "Yes, it is." And we go. All right? It happens. As accounts of American history that serve as a theological corrective to some American myth-making, the black story is important. I want you to hear that. These two theological accounts of American history, one white and one black, continues to divide our churches, and they must be addressed. The price of admittance into the wider community of faith, this is kind of still the deal in America today, cannot be admitting a story that I know is a lie. I must not have to become an ideologue in order to participate in the community of faith. Nonetheless, I wonder if history can function as the basis for a black anthropology or even identity. I say this for the following reasons. In the secular story, this account of black struggle is without guidance. We are free by happenstance. About a one that could have gone the other way. A key speech here or there that stirred the populace. But is our present status a testimony only to human strength, or is there something more? Secondly, where are we going? Whether the black man or black woman in this country? What is our telos and who determines it? If it's completely secular, where are black people going? What's the goal? Third, how does the black story touch on the grander human story that transcends our individual suffering? Are we all strangers, you and I? Or does something that makes sense of the history of black versus white, Japanese versus Chinese, and Jew versus Palestinian? Is there a universal reconciliation that is more than simply sharing our wounds and saying, look how poorly we treated one another? Finally, the claim that what unites black people is deeper than what unites us as Christians is an implicit denial of Christian eschatology, particularly the resurrection of the dead. John the Revelator tells us that one, God will wipe away every tear, and two, we will worship God around the throne. This means that in the end, our pain is not just wiped away, but healed. And that healing results in the community of nations that will worship God for eternity. This is our future, and that's deeper even than slavery. And those are strong words, but so is the gospel. But I'll leave that alone. The black exodus in the Bible as an analogy. If secular accounts of black history cannot function as the basis for black identity, maybe the Bible as a book of liberation can. Liberation theology, of which black theology is one manifestation, has the following characteristics. One, preferential option for the poor. This means that the church's primary job when there is oppression is to sign with the oppressed. Two, the idea that liberation is a vital part of salvation. God wants to save not just our soul, but our whole person. Third, the Exodus is paradigmatic for understanding salvation. Salvation is meaningless then apart from the transformation of social circles, the move, social reality, the move from slavery into freedom. At the core of liberation theology then is a certain Christian praxis that sees the Exodus, even the violent events of that narrative, as paradigmatic for the church's active engagement in the work of liberation. I have some critical things to say about this in a few moments, but surely the magisterium, can I quote Catholics here? Okay, I will. Was right in Libertatis Nuntius, and if you guys know Latin, ignore my bad pronunciation. It acknowledges the following truths in liberation theology. It is important that numerous Christians, and I should have a quote there. Here we go, you guys can see it. It is important that numerous Christians whose faith is clear and who are committed to live the Christian life in its fullness become involved in the work for social justice, freedom, and the human dignity because of their love for their disinherited, oppressed, and persecuted brothers and sisters. More than ever, the church tends to condemn abuses, injustices, and attacks against freedom whenever they occur and whoever commits them. She intends to struggle, and this is actually the key point of disagreement between orthodoxy and certain forms of liberation theology. She intends to struggle by her own means in ways that are distinctly Christian for the defense and advancement of the rights of mankind, especially the poor. The church then does care about the poor, and God is concerned about the whole person. We are involved in the work of liberation. The question is how social and economic justice connect up with conversion to Christ and the transformation of life. But back to the Black Exodus. Black liberation theology has picked up on the theme of Exodus as a fitting image for the experience of people of color in the United States, of Black people in the United States. Like the people of Israel, African Americans found themselves enslaved in a foreign land. Like the people of Israel, African Americans groaned under the harsh treatment of taskmasters while longing for freedom. The Negro spirituals, such as Go Down Moses, evoke this Exodus imagery and the longing for freedom. Go Down Moses is famous for his repeated refrain, "Let my people go." I'm not going to sing it because I can't, so I'll just have to read it for you. Right? It's over and over again. If you remember this song, "Let my people go," returns again and again. "No more in bondage shall they toil, let my people go. Let them come out with Egypt's spoil, let my people go." The song is about Egypt, but it is also about Black freedom. It is a not so subtle call for God to do for Black people what he did for Israel. In these accounts, different characters have played the role of Moses and the Messiah, from Sojourner Truth to Martin Luther King to Barack Obama. They're all figures who've come to lead us to freedom. But this reading of Black identity also focuses on suffering, but it is at least more Christian than the secular narrative. It is true that African Americans and others have found comfort in this idea that God cares about the whole person and that he sides with those who are oppressed. But there are certain limitations of the Exodus analogy. First, some of these readings fail to recognize that the history of Black Christianity precedes slavery. The ancient kingdoms of Nubia and Ethiopia worshiped Jesus without ever having been enslaved. Actually, long before Augustine made his way to Britain to prevent our ancestors or your ancestors from worshiping the trees, there were already Christians in Nubia. But I'll leave that alone. I'll leave that alone. But so the ancient histories of these ancient kingdoms of Nubia and Ethiopia worshiped Jesus without ever having been enslaved. Second, these readings fail to recognize the Bible's own formative impact on the whole of the lives and thoughts of African Americans. Stated differently, the Bible doesn't only appeal to us because elements of the Israelite story match up with elements of the African American story. The Bible and wider Christian theology make certain claims about love, peace, justice, reconciliation, and the transforming power of the Spirit that speak to the Black soul in much the same way that it speaks to the Latino soul, the Asian soul, or the European soul. Yes, slavery and oppression mark the Black interpretation of the Bible, and it informs the questions that we ask. But just as slavery and oppression are not the whole of the Black experience, they're not the whole of our interpretive method. God's love for people of color does not begin with the slave analogy. As I read the Bible, and here I draw on the entire Black preaching and interpretive tradition, it begins first with the universal affirmation of the Imago Dei, Genesis 1, 26 to 28. It's funny because we had a great talk about this yesterday, but Black people have always known what to do with the Imago Dei. It means you can't treat us poorly. But anyways, we'll leave that alone. It also extends to this idea in the Table of Nations that we're all connected. Furthermore, the narrative of the Bible, which climaxes in the coming of the Son, derives its energy from Genesis 12, 1 to 3. And Genesis 12, 1 to 3 says that Abraham's vocation is to bring blessing to the nations of the earth. So while the Exodus is formative, it cannot bear the full weight of Black interaction with the Bible, full stop. Lastly, I wonder if the Exodus' paradigm for societal transformation captures the heart of the biblical narrative. Moses tells Pharaoh to let my people go so that they might worship him. The purpose of liberation is the formation of a people who themselves serve the nations of the world. Exodus gives way to Deuteronomy and Leviticus, the formation of the cult. It is not a freedom simply to determine one's own socioeconomic destiny, as important as that is. Some forms of Christian liberation then can functionally deny the Christian eschatology outlined above, the people who are freed to serve, who worship God, who eventually create a community of nations that bring him glory. Okay, finally, this is the third one. Black Jesus and suffering once more. I think we're beginning to see a pattern that relates to black history and even the black Exodus tradition. Both offer important insights into black identity and possibly African-American accounts of what it means to be human. We are a people with a story. Black Christians are correct to note that our story has interesting points of resonance with the Exodus narrative. We must ask the question as to how we understand that black story under the providence of God. Furthermore, while freedom from slavery is important, freedom from slavery is not the entire basis of our love for the scriptures. It is a point of entry into a relationship with God that is deeper and wider. This brings us to Black Jesus, who will unfortunately receive a small space. I spent too much time on history, but I got into it. So when Black Jesus, when theologians refer to Jesus as black, they do not have in mind his skin tone, but his relationship to the state. This does not mean the question that Jesus' actual skin color isn't important, or that presentations of Jesus as the idealized European are not problematic. That's the topic for another day. But according to these theologians, Jesus' blackness arises in part out of his life as part of an oppressed class and his status as the innocent one who is killed by the state. Hayes, who summarizes Cone, says the following. Jesus, and therefore God, are black, because only as black are they in full solidarity with those who, in the United States especially, have historically been oppressed simply because they are black. This idea then that Jesus is black grows out of the black Exodus. If black folks are analogous to the Israelites, then the Messiah come to liberate the people of color must also be black. Jesus is black, according to them, especially in America, because to call Jesus white is to put him on the wrong side of the power balance in this country. Right? Jesus was a part of the oppressed class, not the privileged class. Therefore, Jesus is theologically black. They would even say ontologically black. That's a different story. But like the Exodus analogy, this limits the appeal of Christ. Yes, black Christians, like all other Christians, are drawn to the love of God, shown the love that God shows to the lowly and the outcast. But we also love Christ because he is not like us. The Messiah, when he came, had a word for Israel and Rome because they both labored under the same sickness. This leads me towards my conclusion and my solution. So we're actually going to deal with black Jesus in the context of talking about the rest of the stuff we have to say. So Jesus as Israelite, and the doctrine of recapitulation. If Jesus as the suffering one, the Exodus, and our history are not a sufficient basis for building a back anthropology or identity, then what is? Here I may disappoint you with what seems like a somewhat traditional Christian account, but I think that the traditional account may be of particular importance in the context of issues swirling around black identity. Jesus as the Messianic King of Israel and Son of God, when placed in the context of the wider Christian story, can be the foundation of an affirmation of black identity. Let me explain this by taking what may seem like a side road to look at F.C. Barr, kind of that pillar of an early generation of biblical studies. And he wanted to explain the origins of Christianity, and its relevance to black Jesus will become clear in a minute. When he wants to explain the origins of Christianity, F.C. Bauer said the following. He said he wanted to show how Christianity, instead of remaining a mere form of Judaism and ultimately being absorbed in it, asserted itself as a separate, independent principle, broke free from Judaism, and took its form as a new form of religious thought and life, essentially differing from Judaism and freed from all its national exclusiveness. According to Bauer, in order for Christianity to become universal, to appeal to every person, it had to become less Jewish. However, Bauer's Jesus and the Jesus of the school of thought that followed in his wake did not become more universal. It became more white and European. It was a Jesus particularly suited to the proclivities of his day. And all this is important to the question of anthropology for the following reason. If Jesus becomes the liberal white Protestant, and Jesus is the image of God, the basis for all our identities, then what does that mean for us? It means the highest form of humanity is white liberal Protestantism or those who can mimic its behavior. The opposite era has been done when we turned Jesus into a white evangelical, but we didn't do that in the 1800s. But anyways, when we limit the identity of Jesus solely to the things that resonate with us, we make the same mistake. This is why Black Jesus and F.C. Bauer are actually closer together than we might think. They're both forms of the same mistake, finding parts of Jesus that resonate with us and elevating them to who Jesus is. What would it mean then to give Jesus back to Israel in order to give him to the world? Jesus as Israelite affirms his particularity. He had an ethnicity and a culture that formed him. The music, food, ceremonies, and stories of his people cannot be separated from his identity without falling prey to the ever-present danger of Marcionism. In the same way, our food, music, ceremonies, culture, and history are important too. There's more. Jesus' words to Israel and his particular customs were not an unqualified yes. He saw the sin and hypocrisy of his people. He saw the ways in which they failed to do all the things that God called them to do. So Jesus' words to his own culture, which had God's word undergirding it, were both a yes and a no. That means that our cultures are not closed off from God's judgment. Jesus' incarnation as Israelite and his critique of it gives us a place to say yes and no to culture. Remember this quote. Oh, that's not it. It must be gone again. I'll read it. It's from the Bible. This is what Jesus said to his people in Matthew 23:37. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those sent to it. How often I've desired to gather your children together as a hen gathers a brood under her wings, and you were not willing. I'm pretty sure that Jerusalem did not like to think of herself as a city that killed the prophets. That's not the glory narrative they like to told. But he told them that as a means for them to confront their own sins and so be saved. Let the reader understand the pertinence of that for our day. But Jesus as Israelite is not simply an affirmation of particularity. It is also a statement about universality. God's purposes in Abraham, as we stated above, was to create a people who themselves bring blessing to the world and undo the damage caused by the fall. Jesus as King of Israel is the fulfillment of these hopes. This means that our very diversity, my Africanness and your Europeanness, together in one family is a manifestation of the universal saving power of the gospel. The gospel demands that my Blackness endure and be visible unto eternity. So Christology, rooted in the biblical narrative then, is the key to Black identity and anthropology. I am who I am because my people were created to offer our distinctive gifts to God. And that all sounds good, but what are the wounds that we've committed or the wounds that we have in our estrangement from God, each other, and ourselves? Like, what do we do about this? The residue of our historic conflicts. How much time do I have?
You have 5 minutes.
Oh, I'm going to finish. This is a miracle. Let me slow down. Okay, then. Okay, here we go. I have 2 pages left. We see how this goes. In one of the earliest articulations of the theory of atonement, Irenaeus, because you got to talk about a father or this isn't the ancient faith conference, right? So here's Irenaeus. Is this good? We're good. Okay. Here's Irenaeus. He posits a theory of recapitulation in which Christ becomes man and passes through every stage of life and in so doing reconciles every aspect of our humanity to God. So that, now this is the right quote, finally. For in what way could we have partaken of the adoption of sons unless we received from him through the Son that fellowship which refers to himself? Unless his word, having been made flesh, entered into communion with us. We need the word to come into communion with us so that we can receive the adoption. Furthermore, he also passed through every stage of life, restoring all to communion with God. So the entirety of Jesus' life is a part of this reconciling work to bring us all into communion with God. When the whole life of Jesus is seen as him reconciling all things to himself, then his decision not to turn Rome into an enemy, even as a child living under the thumb of an empire, becomes a part of his atoning work. His decision to love his own people who have failed him deeply becomes a part of his atoning work. Stated differently, Jesus gathers up all our failures, even our failures to love in himself, and vanquishes them on the cross. Jesus' love for Rome, even in its brokenness, becomes the foundation for racial reconciliation. But again, that love wasn't sentimental or devoid of truth-telling. It was a rugged love that told Rome and Israel the truth about itself. Furthermore, Jesus passing through every stage of life to reconcile us to God also reminds me that God wants to redeem my whole black self. My black childhood, my black teen years, my black adulthood, and are all wrapped up in this grand story of what God is doing in the world. It is a call to be my whole, free, integrated, redeemed black self and see his work and his fingerprints in every aspect of my life. So black lives matter at every age because Christ passed through these ages to reconcile them to God. And this reconciliation, again, has to tell us to unite this distinctly black story to the grand story of what God is doing in his son. Irenaeus, one more time to close. He appearing in these last times, the chief cornerstone, has gathered into one and united those who are far off into those who are near, the circumcision and the uncircumcision, enlarging Japheth and placing him in the dwelling of Shem. That's how you do interbiblical exegesis, by the way. That was for you, Wes. Anyways, Christ's reconciling work then climaxes with the entire family of God united one to another by the blood of Christ, not as nondescript members of a faceless horde. Right? We're not Buddhists. We don't merge into Brahman. Instead, my blackness, which includes the story of my people, our journey to freedom from slavery, and our deep kinship with the suffering of Christ, is affirmed as a unique manifestation of God's desire to create particular people drawn from every tribe, tongue, and nation who bring him glory. Thank you.
It's right on time, so I'm going to call our two respondents, panelists, to come forward, Dr. Grant Lamarquand and Dr. Wesley Hill, both members of our faculty here, and I should say beloved members of this community. So, I'd like to invite one of the two of you gentlemen who has just come up to give some observations and questions, and then whoever, you know, is first, the other person will be second. And since you're both friends, I just really can't decide. So you be gentlemen and figure it out.
Esau, thank you so much. Remarkably rich paper. I can't believe all the ground that was covered and all the avenues for reflection that were opened up. I guess I have one place I want to try to perhaps suggest a buttressing of your argument, and then one place where I want to ask a question about the implications. And I think on your third point, the discussion of a cruciformity to black experience and black identity, and how that is healed and reconciled through the Christ who recapitulates all the ages of our lives, I found myself reflecting on Romans 11. And what's striking about Romans, one of the things that's striking about Romans 11, and this is not original with me, Richard Hayes has observed this, N.T. Wright has observed this, lots of exegetes have observed this, is that in Israel's stumbling, the way Paul describes that stumbling is with a kind of cruciform language or lens. Israel is running the race, and she has stumbled on the stumbling stone. Gentiles are coming in, surprisingly. It was supposed to be the case that Gentiles were saved consequent to Israel's redemption, but ironically, Gentiles are coming in first, and then at the end, all Israel will be saved. And, you know, what's interesting about that to me exegetically is Israel's very own travail and her redemption is caught up in this cruciform self-gift of Jesus. So I wonder if that might actually buttress and undergird a lot of what you've given us in this paper, perhaps by way of analogy.
So that's actually a controversial, like you stumbled onto a part that I avoided on purpose. Huh. And actually, one of the things that happens is because one entire strand of the more radical form of the Black liberation theology is saying that like African Americans have actually taken on that role. Huh. That like we suffer for like basically white America's redemption. Huh. And so this idea that like it's our job, like it's in the movie, the trope that it's always the Black guy's job to kind of give the white guy insight into the world and then help him become his truest self. Yeah. Like, you know, so the magic Negro kind of idea.
So that would be the
yeah, that would be the danger. Yeah. And so this whole idea is that like we need to find a way to account for Black suffering. And this is like the limits of the Israelite narrative. You need to find a way to account for Black suffering that who's in their account, whose telos isn't the redemption of kind of everybody else because of our cruciformity. I actually think that I'm trying to account for a way to talk about Black suffering is being united to Christ without making the complete Israel overlap, because you run into that. And so one of the interesting things too is that like the black power movement and even the current Black Lives Matter movement is explicitly rejecting the strategies of the initial civil rights movement because it was too cruciform. Because the goal of Martin was to get his white neighbor to encounter their own sin through nonviolence and still be transformed. Yeah. And the Black Power movement that came in its wake said, no, we're not going to do that. If you hit me, I'm going to hit you back. Yeah. Now, I think that they're wrong, but that's one of the reasons why I didn't explore that. Yeah. And it's kind of been a fruitful place of inquiry that is kind of contested. Yeah. And one of the things that I'm trying to do is find a way to talk about cruciformity without putting Black people in the role that people have said we shouldn't play.
Yeah, so. Fascinating. Thank you. Yeah. And then maybe just one more question kind of about the implications of your argument. I think one of the most interesting, theologically interesting, secular conversations that's happening right now around race is prompted by Ta-Nehisi Coates' work. You know, his most recent book is We Were 8 Years in Power. The National Book Award-winning book before that was Between the World and Me, you know, very powerfully written books. But Coates has been accused by a lot of white readers, and I think people of color as well have accused him of this, of being too pessimistic about the prospects of racial redemption in this country. I mean, he's an atheist, and he you know admits that he doesn't have any kind of theistic hope. But the question is whether he errs on the side of just kind of unrelenting diagnosis with it without. And I found myself thinking about his work in your first point where you discussed, you know, is history, an adequate category or arena in which to locate Black redemption? And, what I scribbled down was, you know, there's a danger, and this is what I take from Coates's work. There's a danger in allowing hope to function as a kind of tidy theodicy that allows us to, in a sense, prescind from Black suffering, as it were. In other words, I think I, as a Christian, can read Coates's atheistic pessimism and say there's something salutary here for Christian theology. Because if Christian theology jumps too quickly to hope as a kind of, oh, everything's going to pan out in the end, you know, God's going to wrap this thing up, and therefore I don't need to worry too much about the kind of density and difficulty of present Black experience, you know, I think that's a valid critique of a very facile understanding of Christian hope. So
this is why me and Wes are going to be best friends. So continue.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wonder.
The first part of my paper was an extended reflection on Coates. Hmm. That's what that was.
Yeah.
So like the question is like that's what it was. Yeah. So it's funny. I went through two drafts. And the first draft of the paper had just the Exodus and the history part. And then I said, these actually are two different ways of accounting for the Black story, one secular, one religious.
Yeah.
And so the first part of the paper actually took on, and I affirmed, like what I was attempting to do was say, hey, what Coates is actually saying is that the American story that we tell ourselves is a lie.
Right.
And that this is what actually happened.
Right. There,
he's right about this. But his ultimate point is nihilistic. Like, whatever we currently have, he's an atheist. It's happenstance. Yeah. So I didn't have time to go into, like, you then get into the question of arguments for the existence of God and those kinds of questions.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to say is that ultimately, he is hopeless.
Yeah.
And so what I tried to do is say, let's take on this story. There are two theological accounts of American history, one religious, one secular. Interestingly enough, the secular account, I think, is more true to actually what happened. And the question is, well, what do you do when you have this story? Do you just say, well, this is the truth, you're going to die? And that's why I say, well, then why? What happened with black people? Do we have a happenstance? Is there a purpose? Like, where are we going? How do you determine what the future is? For Coates, it really is, this struggle is all that there is. That's what he says. Like, and so black identity, we are the people who suffer and yet we live. Yeah. And I want to say, well, no, that's not the case. But then you really have to do two things. You have to say, and this is prior, there's a story bigger than black suffering. And you have to kind of put black suffering in the context of or the worldwide system and see what's going on there. And two, it really does come to issue of the Christian faith. If I was not a Christian, I'd be a Cotean nihilist, but I'm not because I believe in the resurrection of the dead. So that's when I said the Christian, that's anthropology. So you are very perceptive to say, this is what's going on. This is my attempt to at least take on board this and at least give a not so subtle message to our people that if the price of admittance, if the price of admittance into churches is to adopt an account of American history that we experientially and historically know to be false, is going to continue to divide our churches. If there's like one thing that divides black churches and white churches, it's not theology, it's different accounts of American history and its ongoing implications. And Coates puts his finger on that, but he offers no solution. So you're right, you got it. That was me and Coates having a long conversation in front of one another. He wasn't here, so I don't think I would have convinced him either.
I'll let Bishop Grant weigh in.
I want to echo what Wes said, you know, giving thanks to you, Esau, for a very rich paper. But let me start by saying I'm neither an African nor an American, but I've been a guest in both places. But once again, reading this paper helps me to see that this doesn't let me off the hook, and it reminded me of several things. So let me just start this reflection by doing what Canadians have been doing now for the last 15 or 20 years whenever they start a meeting. And this is happening quite widely throughout Canada. So I want to start by acknowledging that the land on which we are sitting was originally occupied by the Shawnee people and Algonquin people who were forcibly removed from this area in the 19th century to Oklahoma. Only about 14,000 of those people now survive. Other people such as the Monongahela and the Seneca and the Miami and the Creek and the Mingo and other groups of people also occupied this area of western Pennsylvania before white people came here. So we, black and white, are not the first people to be here. I'm not saying that the history of First Nations people on this continent was a pristine kind of, they were all nice to each other during that time either, but just to recognize that we were not the first people here. Which brings me to a story that happened to me. There's a Canadian rock band called the Arrogant Worms, and that the Arrogant Worms actually is a really good description of what Canadians actually are. We know that we're a lot less powerful, and we're really proud of that. So the story is this. I went to Kenya in 1987 to teach in a small theological college. And my boss, the chairman of the board of that theological college, was a man named David Gateri, who is the bishop of Mount Kenya East at the time and later became the Archbishop of Kenya. And I met Gateri when he came for a meeting at the college. And he knew I was going to be there, so he found me and he said, welcome. He said, it's nice to have a Canadian here. We've had Americans. We've had a lot of British people. It's nice to have a Canadian. You guys don't act like you own everything. And I said, well, maybe that's because we've never oppressed anyone. And then he caught me. That was a trap. And I realized it later. He said, without batting an eyelash, it was a very politically incorrect way of saying it, but he said, except the Red Indians. What your paper has reminded me is that that there is no escaping the reality of racism in our world, that racism is not an American problem, that racism is a human problem, and it's very widespread. And that brings me just to a couple of points. There's an intertext in your paper that comes out a couple of times that I think it's probably worthwhile just making explicit. Revelation chapter 7. In Revelation chapter 7, John is having a vision, and after the 144,000 are noticed, he turns around and says, "Then I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes with palm branches in their hands." And the passage ends, of course, with another allusion that you make in the paper, that God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. What's significant, I think, here is that they come with their languages, with their culture. They come as people of particular places. Later on in the book of Revelation, it says that the rulers of the nations bring their treasures into the New Jerusalem. And so one of the things I think we need to think about when we're thinking about race, when we're thinking about culture, when we're thinking about language differences, is what we all contribute together to this global Christian family. So, you
know, one of the things that was, I'm from the South, I'm from Alabama, but I've moved, and one of the biggest things that happened to me in my life, and this relates to this, and I'll get back to it, is when I moved to Japan. And when I moved to Japan and I saw the historic tensions between the Koreans and the Japanese, I was like, oh, they got beef too. And I was just like, that was surprising. And the other thing that was really strange to me is I never felt more American than in Japan, because they don't like Americans. And so they were racist against me for being American. So it was kind of a great feeling. I was like, wow, I'm the master race for a second here. And it's like, get out of our country. I was like, wait a minute, you can't kick me out, I'm black. But anyways. The whole point of that is that it allowed me to see in a real way, like the reality that what's happening between African Americans and white Southerners in particular is one manifestation of a universal problem. And the other thing that was really helpful to me was actually learning about how, like, Pauline ethics works more broadly, and this relates to Revelation, or even ethics in Christianity, which I've never understood why this is not caught on in evangelicalism. So let me run down this road for a second. We are very clear that, at least until yesterday, that our eschatology informs our present-day activities, right? That the whole idea is that we know who we will be in Christ now, in the future, so we live that out now. You've been seated with Christ, therefore live in this way. And so if Revelation clearly marks out the eschatological importance of ethnicity and culture unified, I don't understand how a biblically oriented tradition cannot have this at the center of how they understand the people of God, especially the widespread notion that we, like, I don't see color. Like, what are you talking about? Like, the whole point is eschatological ethnicity, right? That's part of it. And each unique culture bringing their gifts to God. And so I've never understood how we managed to create a theological system with the supposed high authority of scriptures, and then a second part of that being downplayed, caught up in how we understand a new perspective, but you can put that to the side. But it is undeniable that Paul spends all of his time keeping Jews and Gentiles together, because there's something important about what it says about the gospel that these two peoples are together. And so how you can have Book of Acts, and how can you have all of this material running through the New Testament, and then have race reconciliation is the perpetual optional extra. After we've evangelized the world and did these things and adopted all of the people, then we'll think about, like, dealing with this issue. So I'm glad that you brought out Revelation 7:9, because it does inform a lot of my theology, when linked to how Paul does his eschatology, which is looking forward and bringing that forward into our present day reality. Yep. So thank you.
Yeah, and I think, you know, in some ways it's a more helpful way into the discussion than the two primary ways that you mentioned, the Exodus and Black Jesus. The problem with the Exodus, of course, is that the story of the Exodus doesn't just end with worship. It ends with a conquest. And the problem with with the early James Cone version of the Black Jesus is that white people are the devil. So both of those can give us some problems. Revelation 7 really one helps of the, more, well, much there, more.
Yeah, there's two things I would say about that. Like, you have to really see, at least to me, like, black Jesus as the inverse of Bauer's Jesus. It sounds weird to say that. They're really the same. Like, there's certain elements of this story that resonates with our culture, and we isolate them and make them ultimate. But we construct the Jesus who's weaponized against our enemies. And so an accurate appropriation of Jesus, as I understand it, would be someone who challenges us to be more than what we would want to be otherwise, other than the Jesus who actually baptized. I actually had an entire section on, like, sin and James Cone, which we had to eliminate for time, because Cone says something along the lines of sin becomes functionally in America white supremacy, and black sin then becomes the failure to participate in your own redemption. And so when you have those kinds of things, the question really becomes, well, then what, in what ways, other than, like, empowering me, which is fine, you do need to be empowered to fight racism, in what ways does Jesus actually critique us, other than telling us to wake up to be liberated? And so he would really consider, or at least in my reading of this portion of Cone, he would consider one aspect of sin as that kind of dynamic. You need, to me, a doctrine of sin that can account for the wider human experience. But that's kind of easy to say, I guess you want to say, like, outside of, like, wartime. So, like, if you imagine black, what I consider black theology to exist is the failure of mainstream theology to account for these things. So once mainstream theology failed, then you really can't complain. Well, you can, but you can at least understand why some of the people made the arguments that they did, given what was going on in the culture. If your options were, this is why I said atheism is a form of protest. If this is what your God tells me to do, I'll reject him and I'll make another. So.
Well, I have something to add, if I'm not going to get in the way over here. And that's a question about how the many-layered and complex relationship between blacks and Jews in the early 21st century in North America is played out. And the image that comes to me first is what happened in Charlottesville when there were wannabe Aryans dancing around Confederate statues, but what they said was, Jews will not replace us. So there was the presenting issue of racism against black people, but there was an underlying issue.
Well, the history of blacks and Jews being kind of linked together, it was actually black Jews and Catholics back in the day. As the triumvirate, because, like, America was white and Protestant, and so there was this historic link between Catholics as foreigners, Jews as, like, obviously foreigners, and blacks as the people who were historically associated. So I don't know if the history of the United States is kind of the gradual expansion of the definition of white to include basically everybody but black people. And so you do have these places where, in some places, like, even Jews and even Asians have kind of been included in this ideal of, like, proper Americans. But it's always in times of kind of racial tension that circle gets contracted again. And I would say that what you then see in some places are both, once again, the return of anti-Semitism and anti-black. So I would say it's kind of like a cluster of people who are rejected. And I'm not exactly sure. Other than their otherness being the historic roots for that.
Would you say it has anything to do with the fact that Jews are a tribal people?
Well, there's a long history of why Jews were eventually discriminated against. I'm just saying that as it relates to the United States, this idea that America is a white Protestant country undergirded the exclusion of Catholics, Jews, and blacks from mainstream discourse. And that has, like, that triple cluster has kind of changed throughout time, where eventually Catholics were kind of, for the most part, assimilated into kind of this idea of Judeo-Christian America. And even for the most part, Jews were assimilated into that picture. But historically, African-Americans had never fully assimilated into that picture. And I'm not exactly sure why the people in Charlottesville, once again, like, put the Jews back out of the team. But, like, when you're a minority, it's funny, you can read the history of, even the history of the treatment of Jews in Europe. It's like, it's almost random. Like, it's almost an external reality that every now and then people just got mad at Jews and persecuted them for a while, and they kind of went away. So tracing, like, the psychosis of the people in Charlottesville would be beyond my competence.
I could say more, but that's for another lecture. We do have time for questions from the assembly. So if you do have a question, please come to the microphone.
Yeah, besides the theological issues, I mean, there's the practical issue. And I'm part of two organizations here locally that are very adamant and going to great efforts to cross the color line. You know, one is a veterans organization, and those of us who spent a lot of years in active duty in the military worked very closely with African Americans and Hispanics and all kinds of folks. And we worked as a team, and the differentiation was not there, but yet people come home and they go back to their communities and crossing that. The other one is the Episcopal Diocese of Pittsburgh is working in a partnership with Rodman Street Missionary Baptist Church in East Liberty, which is, it's probably majority African-American community. And we have small groups that get together, and I have lots of friends now that I didn't have before. But the practicalities of making it work is very difficult. The Veterans Organization, we've been doing events in predominantly black neighborhoods led by a black veteran, with black veterans telling their stories. But it's very hard to get people across that. We've had a few that come in to a room full of white faces, and they say, well, come sit with us. And then they'd finally realize they really mean it. They want me to come sit with them. But there's this standoffishness, even among people who want to change it. And it's very difficult. You know, I grew up in a predominantly Hispanic area in far west Texas, and, you know, observed a lot of discrimination against people of Mexican descent in the area. And even you go back and have reunions, you know, and the Hispanics go sit in this corner and white people go over here, and nobody wants it, but yet it still happens.
I would say a couple of things, and just one is by way of kind of reminder. And this isn't a criticism, it's the reminder. The question that I addressed, which may have seemed to be a strange question to y'all, how do black people understand who they are, given the historic realities of the fact that it's been denied? And so the paper wasn't first and foremost a model for how we do reconciliation. It was actually an argument for African Americans to conceive of themselves in a certain way and then be willing to participate in this community that historically had separated them. So it was more of an account of black self-understanding. In the course of that account, I gave a very brief history of how African American humanity had been denied to them in this country, which results in historic distrust. And when you've had 400 years, 450 years of distrust, that isn't undone in a lifetime. So it has to be something that people are theologically committed to. Not to say we tried this for 2 or 3 months, it doesn't work, but it has to be something that we can't be who we are unless we have you. And that's the kind of commitment. So I don't have a strategy. I just say that these things are theologically true. And if something is theologically true, it's the church's job to figure out how to embody that in its life and witness. And I want to say the question that I posed that was only partly rhetorical. We're not far enough on the other side of a public manifestation of racism being normative to really assume that there'd be a widespread level of trust. I mean, I didn't want to give years, but you could say up through the 70s and the 80s, it was possible to campaign on robustly and blatantly racist politics. And to know, if you read it and you watch these YouTube commercials now, you go, did they do that in the 80s? Mm-hmm. So we're only and you can go there up through the 1990s. In the most recent election, sorry, this is not to talk about politics, this is the reason why this is important, for historic distrust, which is what's undergirding your problem. One of the problems that Clinton ran into is they could pull the stuff that she said in the 90s about bringing black people to heel in the Democratic Party, calling black people super predators, that was they're still with us. So we kind of go, we haven't been racist for the last 18 months. Why aren't black people coming to hang out with us? Well, it's because rightfully, we're a little bit, let's wait this out a decade or two and see how this goes. And the question really becomes is, are we able to say, yes, we had publicly manifested racism up through the 90s, but we stopped doing that, and now they don't want to come, especially in a context where we can have to be honest, publicly manifested racism in the last election. And so one of the things that's really interesting is how I've had to actually change how I talk about this. Before 2 years ago, I talked about when socially accepted racism came to an end. And then in the last 2 years, it's been a shift to say, we're now actually in a place where we're, like, my argument used to be, we're only in a short window of time where it was publicly unacceptable to be racist. But now I actually think that we're in a place now where, under the guise of no longer being politically correct, it is publicly acceptable to have manifestly racially insensitive things be a part of public discourse, which explains some of the distrust to people aren't automatically going to join these multicultural organizations and ministries unless there's some real long-term commitment. So, sorry.
Father Esau, my brother, help me out. Okay. My daughter, my one and only daughter, in October is going to be marrying a black man.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Because he's a very fine man.
The food's going to improve in your family, so go ahead.
A very fine man, a Christian. He's not an Orthodox Christian, but he's a...
Everybody makes mistakes.
That's where I'm going with
this. There we go, there we go.
And I'm not trying to make him Orthodox or anything, but he's very intelligent. He's an MIT graduate and a math teacher in a boarding school in Montgomery, Alabama.
That's another mistake he's got.
He's not from, he's from St. Louis. And when I first met him a couple years ago, and we were talking, the first question he asked me was, knowing who we are and what I am, what is your relationship to the first century church? I thought, wow, perfect, good question. And then I later found out he is part of the Church of Christ, the restorationist wing, the more conservative, non-instrumental wing. And probably because of my stereotyping, I immediately went for the black stuff, and there is in the Orthodox Church, I don't know if you've heard of him.
St. Moses the Black, I know about all of it.
Yes, you know him?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
So I was cluing him into all this stuff and loading him up with books like that.
Yeah, Desert Fathers, Alexandria.
Yeah.
So what's the question?
The question is, he's more interested, he thinks more like a Protestant than any of this, interested in the ancient roots of the church in Africa and all that. He wasn't really interested. I'm dealing with more of the Protestant. But how?
So how do we make him Orthodox? Is that the question?
We
make him appreciate the ancient church?
How do we make him interested in ancient Christianity?
I would say the black people aren't, like, we're not magic. I think the same thing that makes anyone interested in the ancient church is what makes African Americans interested in the ancient church. I get a lot of people asking, like, how do I, like, evangelize black people? I mean, like, we all share a common humanity. And one of the things that we tend to think of is there's this, like, this separation between each other. It takes a special technique. And I would say that, like, to me, religious conversion, or even interreligious whatever you want to call all of the stuff that we do, is in part a work of grace. And so either he loves the liturgy or he doesn't. I mean, like, I love the liturgy, and like, we just tend to, black people, you need to like make the liturgy blacker. No, you don't. You just do the liturgy and the seasons and the fathers and those things. There's a significant portion of white people who have no desire to be Orthodox or Anglican, and we just go, oh, they just don't like it. We don't go, how do I get white people to get Orthodox?
Well, he does,
right?
Like going to church.
So it's just like, you introduce them to the liturgy and let the Spirit do its work.
No, he likes going to church. And you got to that's the first thing you got to like, not like the books about ancient Christianity.
Yeah, so I would say that it's the work of grace.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't have a strategy.
That's fine. Great, thanks.
So I'm originally from Wisconsin, and I've been a pastor in South Carolina for the past 2 years. So I've been reading up on African-American history now that I'm a Southerner. And
live in the South.
What's that? South Carolina? South Carolina. Drinking my sweet tea. Yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I am a cheesehead. I have a cheesehead in my office, actually. So My question is about the liberation theology and the Exodus narrative as a paradigm. So I was wondering, would the Exodus paradigm be best, or what about the exile narrative? Because with the Exodus, you know, they went there voluntarily, and once they were gone, they were free from Egypt. But with the exile, they were forcibly removed from their home. They had to live in a foreign land under foreign domination. And even when some of them did go back home, they were still under foreign domination. But even with the diaspora, they were always like the minorities under foreign power.
There's two things to that. One is the Exodus paradigm functions because the Israelites, in that sense, were innocent. And in the exile narrative, they're punished for their sins. Now, interestingly enough, there's a group called the Black Hebrew Israelites who argue that African Americans are still under the covenant curses outlined in Deuteronomy 28. And that until they kind of repent and become like come under the law, African Americans will continue to suffer. So there is actually a black religious kind of cult that sees themselves as being functionally under the exilic curses outlined in Deuteronomy. They're wrong, but they exist. And they're actually becoming more and more prominent on black church, at HBCU campuses and those kinds of places. And a lot of people who are involved in black apologetics are actually interacting with the Black Hebrew Israelites.
I'd just add that in South Sudan, there are a large number of Christians who will read Isaiah 18 against themselves, that the death of all these black people in Isaiah 18 is because they were sinners, and that's why we're having a civil war.
Okay, so the exile narrative isn't helpful because the exile was because of Israel's sin.
Well, I think that there's limitations of the Exodus narrative too, and so I would just say that the exile narrative would be a different manifestation, and there's an entire religious group that functions using that as a means of recruiting black people to understand, once again, a lot of black anthropology is trying to come to grips with black suffering, like why are we treated so poorly? And people have been grasping at different parts of the canon to try to figure it out. And there's a group that's turned to the exilic text, or at least the curses that led to exile, as a basis for understanding who we are. It's our fault. So.
Well, since pedigree is appearing to be important, I should say that...
It's okay.
Well,
you don't have to give me your whole life story.
I am not...
I get it every time I go to something. People have to give me, like, every black person they've ever met. But it's fine.
I haven't met that many.
Yeah, I'm not mad.
But I've lived in South Carolina and there North Carolina, but I'm not a Southerner.
Oh, there we go. As long as you confess it.
My question has to do directly with black identity, rather than the Christian aspect of it. And it is that, as we all well know, in this country, there has been a history of discrimination against many groups. Certainly it's been worst against the black population. But, I mean, the Jews have faced tremendous discrimination. The Italians, the Irish, the Japanese, and the Chinese currently do. But in spite of the discrimination and oppression that they have experienced, and in spite of being in a foreign land, they, I believe it's fair to say, have all maintained a sense of their own identity in the face of exploitation or discrimination. And what I am questioning is, how is it that the black population has questions about its identity?
Because our identity was stolen from us. So Japanese, everyone else who you mentioned immigrated here for the most part willingly and had some organic connection to their past. They could trace their history. Like, I don't know where I'm from. One of the things that's really interesting that's happening now is I could go back and find out, like, if I wanted to do a DNA test, I could find out what part of Africa I'm from. But a part of me finds that somewhat, and I don't know exactly why, but emotionally devastating. I've lived my whole life not having an idea of like what part of Africa I'm from. And I don't know what it would mean to find out that I was Ugandan or Nigerian or something else. And so I would say there is a unique, and one of the things that I try not to do is get into a suffering fight. So to say that like black people had it worse, and no matter what you said, you find another like way. Or if there is like women being oppressed, and I go, well, women have it bad, but black people, look at slavery. And so I tend not to go to like the suffering Olympics, but I would say that it's important to recognize the uniqueness of slavery in the United States as a perpetual institution that happened generation after generation, as opposed to what happened with most other immigrant groups, where you considered other for a while and then you eventually added to the category of white. And so one of the things that has not happened is that for African Americans, because it was race-based, it was on our skin, we've never been mainstream into whiteness. And one of the things that you can see, even, and the reason I quoted the Jesuit earlier, the missionary to Japan, from the beginning, the missionaries saw Asians as the good kind of minorities. When they made the scale, they said, okay, if we can get the Japanese and the Koreans, they can be good Christians. And so for a variety of reasons, even though there's tons of racism against Asians, I don't want to dismiss what's happened in the United States, but there's been basically in America a path into whiteness that every other ethnic group has been granted. And not to say that that's our goal is to be a path into whiteness, but for whatever reason, African Americans have historically been separated from that. And we actually don't have a history that we have documentation of that goes back behind the Middle Passage, right? Like our identity is we were the people who were brought here. So when your identity, the beginning of your story as you know it is my ancestors were slaves, then the question of who I am becomes different than if I can say that my ancestors were these people in Ireland or wherever. So that would be, I would say, the main difference.
So in your community, then, you don't trace your history back into Africa?
But Africa's a continent, right? I mean, like, to say that I'm from Africa is like saying I'm from Europe.
Well, okay.
So I can't just say I'm African. I mean, I say I'm African, but it's a really, I mean, and then to say, like, I mean, it's a continent. And so when you're saying, like, I am an African-American, it just means basically I'm from over there. Versus, like, I can say that my family were in this. I have friends who would go to Scotland and find their ancestors and go to the village where their family was from. Or British people who say that my family came over here on the Mayflower, right? I can tell you this story. And I say, it is true. Like, black people, we came here on the good ship Jesus, right? This is how we got here. And so those different accounts of what it means to be here have formative impacts. And that's a part of American psychosis to think that like our beginnings have a large impact on our end. It's how we do psychology. The origins explain everything. But if the origins explain everything in our culture, then our origins are particularly problematic as African Americans, as far as it comes to constructing an identity.
Okay. I just let you know, I can't tell you where my family comes from either.
I can.
Where my family comes from?
No, mine. I'm going to press on our friendship here, Esau, a little bit. But I can tell you where my family comes from, and I can tell you that my family comes from Scotland, and some of them were slave dealers. And I can also tell you that some of my family comes from the mountains and saw themselves as poor and oppressed. And I'm living both of those stories. And I have a lot of questions, and I think they're all one, but I don't know how they fit. But how do you take a people who are on the outside white and the oppressor and on the inside the oppressed and say, this is your black brother whose identity was stolen, I really thank you for those words, by some of your ancestors. And other of your ancestors were just as poor and beaten and disenfranchised. And in some ways, you're very much the same. And wrestle with those two identities that I think actually live in a lot of white people today in a way that's constructive and that draws us together. A side note, and Esau knows, and some of you who know me know, I am as white as they come as far as I know genealogically, and I'm sure if I go back further, I'll find some more surprises, but I'm also the mother of a Korean child who would love to take a DNA test and know exactly how Korean he is. He's just curious. His identity's broken in a different way. How do I wrestle then with that? And there's a wonderful artist from Korea, Kim Ki-chung, who, as in so many traditions, took Jesus and painted him in Joseon oppressor dynasty. Those were the powerful people of Korea, and put Jesus in that situation.
Yeah.
And how do I deal with that image? It's a lot. I'm just throwing it at you.
There's two things I would say. is, and I'm not talking about you personally.
It's okay.
It's amazing how like nobody is responsible for what happened to us. Like everybody's family was poor. And like as the story is told. So I'll say there's two things corporately. One of the things that happens is that America tells a story of its a corporate narrative about itself, its posture before the world, right? As this glory, the glory narrative, as I call it. The first thing that I would say, they have to adopt, understand that's a lie. It's a lie. And so once we accept that story as a lie, then it actually gives a question for a particularity. So what tends to happen is, okay, there's this grand story that I go, this story isn't true. And then someone goes, but my family was poor. So like, I'm not convicted in this, like, you see how it works? So the first thing you have to say is, hey, this story that we still tell ourselves about who we are as a country is fundamentally dishonest. We have to own that dishonesty and then adopt kind of a more humble posture towards what it means for us to be us. And once that kind of happens, then you can deal with the individuality. Because the critique has never been that every single white person was rich. The critique has been that corporately America did these things. And that there has to be some concept of corporate guilt, which exists in every other element except for racism. We could say America is corporately guilty for like allowing abortion. God, heal our nation of this corporate sin. God's going to judge us as a country. God's going to judge us for our, I don't believe this, what people say, about for human sexuality. Like we are corporately guilty as a country for doing this thing. But then when we talk about like racism, everybody's an individual and nobody knows what happens and nobody's family did these things. And so we found a way to construct a theology that allows us to individually be innocent of everything and continue a disjunctive narrative. And so what I would say, the first thing that I would do is I would try to teach my children or teach people the truth. These are theological accounts of American history where God's providence leads us to manifest destiny and conquer the whole world. This stuff has to be dealt with theologically, and then we can get to the individual questions, because I think that what people are really saying is, even if that narrative is true, my people didn't benefit from it. And there is a sense of identity that happens as an American, that even if you're poor, you get a sense of self-worth from being a part of the greatest country in the world. Right.
I totally agree with you. And I see, and I think everyone here, I think that's the mood of the room. But how do you take that then into those pockets of the mountains where I came from, not too far north of your roots in Alabama, and who are intensely individualistic and intensely closed off, and say, you actually are part of that bigger whole, even though you don't want to know
it. Are they patriotic? Do they have flags in that? They have flags?
Not my family, but yes.
So it's amazing.
I'm sorry, I know
I have to stop. It's amazing how like they're individualistic, but they're patriotic. So don't fail to kneel in front of that flag, because it's about America and all that we've done.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, let me just say, when you said flags, I heard rebel flag.
Okay.
I meant the American flag. That is the culture I came out of.
Yeah, the American flag. So I know we got to go. We'll talk.
All right.
We have time for one more person. I'm sorry, back there.
So thank you, by the way. This was really beautiful. I'm a composer by trade, and lately I've been trying to write more music from perspectives that are not my own. I recently wrote a piece with a text. I commissioned it, but it's by a first-generation Mexican immigrant, and I tried to write from that perspective. The feedback that I've gotten from that has been kind of mixed. There have been people who have been really glad that I'm doing it, but other people who have said, that's not my story to tell. And I guess I'm sort of curious to hear your reflections on how I or we or the white church, whatever, can partner and come along with what you're saying in a way that is respectful and helpful without getting into sort of the inappropriate kinds of appropriation.
Well, I think you can't do anything well without doing it poorly. So I think that like it's rare that people go from being completely racially unaware to aware and kind of participating without making mistakes. And when your hearts are in the right place, I know a lot of African Americans, the people of color, are patient. Right? They're patient with slightly awkward questions or inappropriateness if I feel like I'm not being tokenized. And so I would assume that like grace covers a multitude of sins. And so what you have to do is be humble enough to make those mistakes, learn from those, and accept criticism. What tends to happen is that someone gets inspired by something, and then they do something related to race and justice, and then it's not received well. They're not kind of received the glory that they expected, and then they quit and they give up. It's almost the same as when people think, oh, the Bible says I should care about poor people, and they go into the inner city or they go to some other place, and the poor people are kind of mean to them. And they thought, wow, I thought that you would be happy that I'm here giving you this food or doing whatever, and you're not appreciative of my generosity. So I'm going to go back to my suburban place and say, well, that didn't work. I didn't get the kind of the dopamine or whatever you want to call it from this service. And so it has to be a theological conviction. And so that's the reason why, once again, I have to say our eschatology has to inform our practice. If this is where the church is going, we know this. The question isn't whether or not the church is going to be diverse. Revelation tells us the church is diverse. It will be eschatologically. That means there is no, this didn't work, we get to quit, we suffer. And one of the things that happens, and I'll just say this, a lot of times the church is kind of labor under a truth that they didn't have a good idea about, right? And a good example of that is evangelicalism. I'll say this. They kind of knew, well, a lot of this stuff that's going on with the Bible, we're not doing, like, when kind of this first stuff happened, liberalism in its modern form came, we kind of said, you know what? This isn't healthy. And all of the arguments that they said in the 50s, 60s, and 70s have not aged well. But they were instinctively on to something, right? That in the face of this ever-changing culture, there's something about the scripture that we need to hold on to. And I would say we've arrived now at a much more healthy approach to the authority of scripture and what it means to be submission to it. But there was a time we kind of labored under even somewhat inadequate arguments that we've kind of now buttressed. But it was a conviction that carried them through, almost waiting on the providence of God for someone to come and help them out. And so I would say what has to happen sometimes is that the church has to carry a conviction of something is true, even when our methods haven't caught up to that conviction, or even our arguments haven't caught up to it. It's not a closed-minded intellectualism. It's a suspension of judgment or a suspension of giving up during a time of difficulty. And so we're going through a phase of difficulty, but our convictions cannot waver as we move through it. And in the providence of God, somebody's going to show up. Maybe one day William Barclay will come and explain to us how grace works, right? And then it's all taken care of. So, John Barclay, sorry. And it was Watson was your guy anyway. I should have said something Watson did. But anyways, that's what I would say. I would say just like labor until a good idea comes along.
I want to say thank you to our speaker and to our panelists. And we have an announcement.